My guidance counselor told me at the end of my junior year that I should probably join the military or get into Job Corps or something like that, because I wouldn't be able to make it or further my education to do anything else. After I left that guidance counselor's meeting, something went off inside of me, and I said, you know what? I am going to prove her wrong because of what she said, because I knew what I could do if I really went into it 100%.
Hello, and welcome to A Pixie from Kilmarnock, a program about the people, places, and history of the Northern Neck of Virginia. I'm your host, Pixie E. Curry. If you have been listening to any of my interviews, you have listened to Captain Carol Curry, the retired Menhaden fishboat captain who worked on the East Coast. One of his comments was how hard it was to secure the position as a captain of any boat if you were a black man fishing the waters on the East Coast. That it was easier if you went south being the state of Louisiana, to work on the Gulf of Mexico. While growing up on the neck, it was not out of the ordinary for men to leave their homes to work down Louisiana. Men will leave their families for up to 6 months for better pay and opportunities, many electing to move there permanently. A constant while doing interviews with Dr. Elton Smith, Jesse Davenport, and Captain Curry was the frequency of names of men who worked and captain boats. Names like Captain Charles Charlie Winstead, Captain Virgin Gus Dunaway, Captain Clinton Hill, Captain Charles Lee Forrester, Captain Matthews Sonny Boy Gaskin Sr., and some others. Some of the aforementioned names are familiar names to some of us from the neck. Generational family names that carried on the tradition of being watermen and commercial fishermen. This interview with Captain Matt are in two parts. I interviewed Matt in April of 2021, the day before he was to crew his boat to set out for the season on the Gulf. As it is with old friends, Matt and I talked on the phone for over an hour. And for those who know me, that was a short conversation.
My name is Matthews Gaskin Jr. Occupation now is I am affiliated with the fishing business, commercial fishing with Omega Protein, and I am going back to work Wednesday to start the 2021 season. I was born in Weems, Virginia, 1956.
What schools did you go to, Matt?
The schools I went to, grade schools, I went to Mount Jean School in Weems, Virginia, first grade to the fourth grade, which is now the one of the educational buildings now in Lancaster County, Lancaster Public Schools. Then I went from the fifth grade to the ninth grade to Brookville High School in Mantua, Virginia, Mantua. And from the ninth to the 12th, I went to Lancaster High School, when the schools became integrated. And I was the first class to graduate from the new high school in Lancaster County, in Lancaster, the new high school this year. That was in 1974, graduated there.
You also was part free choice when the black schools and the white schools, still they're integrated, but you had the choice of staying in the segregated school or going to the integrated school. So you were part of that time.
Yes, ma'am.
What choice did you make?
Well, I chose to integrate because I wanted to compete with other cultures other than my own, and I chose to do that. As far as for sports and and academics as far as schoolwork, too. I guess you can say I wanted to compare myself to them as far as on an educational level. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
And on a sports. I love sports, and I really thought that I was the best at what I've done. And in order to be the best, you got to play the best. And that's what I did.
When you made that transition from going from a segregated school to the integrated school, what was the first difference that you noticed?
Well, the first difference I noticed was that I was in the class with people that was different than what I was, color-wise. They dressed different. They looked different. And as far as with my teachers, they looked different. They were different. Their cultures were much different than what mine was as far as being raised in a black community. And them being raised in a white community, there was the differences that I noticed right from the start.
As you became, for lack of a better term, indifferent to how they look, what were the other differences that stood out to you?
The way we talked and the way they talked. With myself, I was one to be accepted because of being raised to get along with everybody. I wanted to learn them like they wanted to learn me. So I became very popular in the school. And as far as sports, everybody wanted to know the basketball players, the football players. So they adapt to me very well. That didn't go that way with everyone, but with me, it did.
For most of the black population, if not all, that when they made that choice to go to the integrated schools, that pretty much all of us black kids were taught that we're going to get along regardless. We went in with that kind of armor, for lack of a better term, that we were just going to go and be ourselves. A lot of people was looking for friction because the white kids had been brought up to think of us in a different way.
That's the way, right.
Versus, you know, we always knew how they were, but we were going to be ourselves regardless. It is no surprise that you would have been popular because you were just going to be Matt Gaskin.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
The other part of it is that when you say competing against the best was already within the segregated schools. It's just going to another dimension of that. That being said, did the teachers, did the other students, did they try to know about what it is to be a black person? Was black literature taught? Was the black music, our style, our sway, was that something that they were accepting of? By then, you know, the Afros were way out there. And I know for a fact that you had one of the best in the counties.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of thing, that acceptance, classmate, your white classmates, was that something that just went without a hitch? Did you get any kind of flack from being black?
Well, I did because, like we said, Chief, I was already accepted by my own as one of the coolest guys in my race. When we became integrated, some of the guys, they really wanted to be my friend because I was a cool, hip dude, and they wanted to. They were something like me. They wanted to learn our culture. Like I wanted to, like I said, I knew theirs, but I just wanted to see because all of them were different. Some were raised poor, you know, and they were different because they accepted us better than those who were raised, as you can say, with a silver spoon in the mouth. I was accepted by both, and they wanted to learn our music. You know, we used to have our school dances, and they would look at us dance, and we had some who wanted to dance like us. We had some who wanted to talk like us, and we even had some who wanted to have an afro. So it was a learning experience, and a lot of them, I gained a lot of friends by, as you can say, being hip and really to be accepted, because if one group accepts you, then the other one would too. So I learned to cope with the, I guess you can say, the higher standards, the mid standards, and the lower standards, opposites of us. So yes, I learned a lot from them, and they learned a lot from me. I didn't mind passing our culture on to them because they thought it was real cool that some of the things we done, especially the way we danced and the way we styled our afros and how fast we could run and how we could run up down that basketball court, shoot those hoops. That was really all we had to do, you know, back in that growing up, you know.
Who were your favorite teachers?
My favorite teachers were, I would say, in grade school, Miss E.B. Nicken. She was principal at our school at Mount Jean. She really inspired me because she wanted to see us grow and accomplish things. Didn't want us to stay where we were because she knew that a change was going to come, and she was trying to prepare us for that change. On the way, we spoke, just like when somebody would call to the school, she had us as students to answer the telephone and not answer it like, hello, you know, answer it in a professional manner. The way, as far as we dressed, as far as to make sure your shirt tail was in, make sure your hands were clean, your appearance was something that she really stressed in us, and that was instilled in us at a very young age, and I really did appreciate that. And when I came up to Brookville, the husband and wife's team, Harvey Boyer and his wife, Miss Mary Boyer, they were from Weems, from where I was from, but they were teachers also who they wanted us to really learn, because they knew one day that these schools would be integrated, and they wanted us to be on a level better than what we were. So they really stressed education in us. And they said that we have to have it because it was going to be a strike against us to get out here into this world without the education. And all of those things, I really did like them. But then as I got into high school, I had some white teachers that really, they taught me a system. It was different. I was having trouble in math in my earlier days on the way I was being taught. And I had a teacher named Mr. Cooley that came to our school. And he had a system. He had a method, man, and it was so easy. Couldn't believe how easy math was from his system. So, you know, you find out that in school, you had teachers who were good teachers, and they say that some people had learning disabilities, but it also was the way we were taught. Some had a different system, and the system that they used that was easier for us to learn. It was just a different world opened up to me to see the difference, man. And I was so excited where my worst subject became my best subject right until this day now. Mathematics is something that just instilled in my head, and I always think of him when I, you know, have a problem or somebody throw a problem at me. And I really appreciated that from black teachers and white teachers. And I had some that were very challenging to us, and I adapted to them also because I knew I wanted to have a 4.0 grade point average, you know, and I worked hard to maintain that and to do that and graduated with that. So, but the teachers that I had, though, some of them made it hard for us, some made it very easy for us, and I appreciate that. I appreciate the hard ones, and I appreciate the ones that made it easy.
I think about some of the kids who had problems. They could have had a hearing problem. They could have had sight problems. They could have been dyslexic. See, I can't pronounce certain words. Not being able to follow a certain system, and them probably being brushed aside. And you just never know what was the potential that was wasted because someone didn't know how to assess the problem. I always think about students like that, you know, that could have benefited from a different approach. Who was your mentor as you was growing up?
My mentor was my mother and my father and grandparents. They were an inspiration to me. And I tell you, man, I love them for being, as I thought growing up, was the worst parents a kid could have.
You sure you're not talking about J.C. and Shirley May?
I'm telling you because I think you and I, we were in a family with seven in our house, too. You know the discipline that they instilled in us. Like they said, the day these kids would call 911. But I tell you one thing. When Beatrice Gaskin and Sonny Gaskin told you, you do what I say, and you did what they said. We had chores, we had homework, we had family time, and we went to church on Sundays. We ate dinner and blessed our food before we ate. Growing up in that kind of household, man, and I instilled it in with my kids. I passed it right on down to them. And I'm so proud of them now because my youngest daughter, the generations have changed because mine is from 18 to 47. So it's a gap in between. But before you eat, you bless what you have in front of you. So I have instilled prayer in them, and I put the morals in them like my parents put in me, and it still works.
You are listening to A Pixie from Kilmarnock with an interview with Captain Matthews Gaskins, Jr. In a previous interview with Captain Carol Curry, I said he was old school. Captain Matt Gaskin represents the future with the new technology and better conditions in an industry that his father and the other captains and crews could only dream about, but still keeping some of the old school ways in the just in case file. What was your first job?
My first job was a landscaper, probably at the age of 7 or 8. I was always blessed being able to fix things. In our little community, which consisted of my grandparents, my mom and dad, my aunt and uncle, and the next door neighbors who all helped to raise us, they would throw things away. We had a place back in the woods that was our trash pile. But before they would throw them away, they would say, "Matt, that's something I want y'all to take down to the trash pile." Whether it would be a fan, a television, a radio, some type of electrical thing. And I would take them and play with them. I was good at taking things apart now. But then I had to put them back together. So. But I would troubleshoot things at a very young age and find out that it was only a broken wire that needed to be put back together, something like that. But my grandfather had a lawn boy, and it was called a lawn boy. And that thing, they could nobody in the neighborhood get that thing started. They cranked and cranked and cranked. And he told me to take it back there and throw it on the dump. So I took it in the backyard, and I started playing with it, started checking things out with it. And I found out that it had two screws on it. One was for the gas, and one was for the air. And somebody had tightened those screws all the way up where it wasn't getting any gas and wasn't getting any air. He went and bought him a new lawnmower, and I took and slacked those screws off and got a pop. Then I slacked them off some more and got a pop, pop. And then the third time I slacked them off, I had it running. When they came home from work that evening, I had the old lawnmower out there cutting our grass, and they said, "This boy right here, you know, he is just special. She can fix anything." And my grandfather gave me that lawnmower, and I took that lawnmower, and I got yards in the neighborhood. I had a gallon can of gas, which I think at the time gas was like maybe 20-some cents a gallon, and I had that 1 gallon can in my lawnmower, and I had about 5 or 6 yards in the neighborhood where I made about maybe $40 in a weekend. Boy, that was a lot of money at 7 or 8 years old.
Yes.
That was my first job. Yep.
That was your first job. Wow. Mm-hmm. Another rite of passage for living on the Northern Neck is working at the Ties Inn. I know you worked there.
I sure did. I worked at the Golf Lodge, which was in Wings, where I used to walk to work there. I started out at the Ties Inn working on the yard because I still had the passion to. I could take something that was ugly and make it look beautiful. And they noticed that about me. I didn't have a boss. They just told me to keep the place pretty. And as far as asking, "What do y'all want me to do?" they told me to do whatever I wanted to do. And I did. And I made the place look beautiful. And they saw my work effort. And when they needed somebody to fill in somewhere, they would take and tell me, "Well, Matt, can you... go over to the laundry room. The laundry girl couldn't come in today. Can you do the laundry?" That's as far as with the things coming out of the hotels and from the pool. So I learned how to do that. And in the hotel, they needed somebody to work in the hotel. They would ask me, "Matt, can you come over and work in the hotel?" So then they had a shortage in the dining room. And they asked me, could I run home, clean up, come back, and work the dining room? And I did that. My break came one day. They needed help in the main office. Asked me, would I go home and put a white shirt on? And they gave me a Scottish necktie. and asked me could I come and help in the front office. So I went from being a yard boy, coming to work with a shirt and tie on, working in the main office at the Ties Golf Lodge. And in the winter, they wanted to transfer me when they were short over at the Ties Inn. They wanted me to come over to the Ties Inn to help out there. So I guess you could say I was a swing man for both places. Then they had me as a bartender going on the cruises on their boats because they knew I had knowledge of the water. So I was going out on the moonlight cruises on the high tide, going out to the Rappahannock River Bridge, taking them out there for a moonlight cruise and bringing them back to the dock.
What was the name of the boat?
The name of the boat was the High Tide over in at the Ties Golf Lodge, and it was the Miss Anne at the Ties Inn.
You on the water. That what sort of connect us all is the water. How do you start working on the water and when?
I started working on the water. My father being a waterman, my grandfather being a semi-waterman because he was a farmer at an oyster house there in Weems, and he also crabbed and fished. He was like an entrepreneur. But my father was straight-up waterman. My father oystered, he crabbed, he fished, he did it all on the water. So being a young boy out of five boys, I was always the one that he would say, Matt, come on, go with me. And I had a problem with that. And I went to my mother and said, Mom, how come he don't get the older brother? Why does he always have to get me? And so my mother told me that, Matt, he sees something in you that he don't see in his other boys. So I learned everything that it was to know about it. And I said, when I get 18 years old, man, I don't have to worry about this water no more. I can go do what Matt wanted to do. And of course, the rest is history.
Well, I want to know, because I knew you as we were growing up, and you were a fantastic athlete, as was your brother Stanley. Did anyone ever try to help y'all get athletic scholarships? Was there any preparation from the guidance counselors to help you all to go to college?
Well, this is what happened with that situation. Stanley, of course, was a great athlete. He was one of the top ball players of his era. And he also, they won the state championship the last year of Brookville before the schools became integrated. And he was one of the pitchers. Stanley had a tryout with the Baltimore Orioles, which he probably could have went on to play pro baseball, but he decided to get married and do different things. With myself, my guidance counselor told me at the end of my junior year, because I was a get-by student where I had to maintain a C average to play ball, play athlete, you know, to play in school. And she told me at the end of my junior year that I should take and probably join the military or get into, Job Corps or something like that, because I wouldn't be able to make it further in my education to do anything else. And after I left that guidance counselor's meeting, something went off inside of me, and I said, you know what? I am going to prove her wrong because of what she said, because I knew what I could do if I really went into it 100%. And at the time in high school, I was only into it 50%. My senior year, I maintained an A and B average, and I graduated from high school. I received two scholarships, one from Farnham College and one from Virginia Union University, to play ball and for my education, having a grade point average. And during the time that I was supposed to go to school, my father on a fishing boat so that I could make some money so I wouldn't have to spend his money. So that's how my fishing career got started. And as far as with my guidance counselor, you know, going to work, I got my master's and 5 years later, I got a degree in mechanics. And when they had career day, I came back to Lancaster High School because they asked me, would I come? And my first stop was the guidance counselor's office, and she was still there. And I went there to thank her because of her telling me that. Because maybe if she had never told me that, my life could have been turned around completely. So
she pushed you.
I thank her for that. Yeah.
She pushed you.
She did.
Did I hear you say that you got your master's?
Yes, ma'am. I got my master's in New Orleans, Louisiana. And I got a master's in navigation, something that very few people have, black or white. And I accomplished that goal at a very young age. I decided to hold on to a job, commercial fishing. And in 5 years, I became one of the youngest black captains ever hired by a corporation at the age of 24.
Check you out.
Yep.
We're going to come back to that because I want to go back to something else. I want to know, what is your first memory of racism?
Oh, man. Well, I can go back as far as to growing up in Lancaster County, going to Kilmonnock, walking around town, going into the drugstores, trying to get a meal from Lee's restaurant, telling us that we could order from the back, ordering from the counters in the drugstore, telling us that we had to take it with us, going in the stores, Ben Franklin, and being watched on every aisle that you were going. And that was at a very young age. And as far as just being with my mom, going to, you know, to the doctor's office, going into the grocery stores. I just saw it everywhere. And that was at a very young age.
Going back to you being the youngest black, but just being the black captains on the boats, you and my Uncle Carol, who were some of the other black captains, a rarity in the Northern Neck.
It was a captain, and his name was Captain George Jones. He was one of the first. He was originally from North Carolina. He came, and my father, that was his mentor, because my father worked with him. And him as a black captain, he instilled in my father to become a captain, which my father did. And he told him that, pass it on. You pass it on and just keep it going so that we could get more black captains. And at that time, we had up north. The only head was George Jones. He was old and he retired. And my father, he became a captain. And he more or less worked in New Jersey, North Carolina. He was affiliated in Reedville at an old Seacoast dock there where they would come in and tie up. And then your Uncle Carol, first in the Omelet until 2021, which we have one now that's going to be going as a captain this year, that's 65 years old, that started out the same as what I did. And, you know, and it went on to down south, to North Carolina, on to Mississippi, and Louisiana, and Texas, where we started to get more black captains. Down south, they were a little more advanced with the black captains there than what they were up north. So there were very few up north, and it's 2021 now. There's only one there now. So
that's,
for years, there was no.
That's Kirk Lee you talking about?
That is Kirk Lee, yep. And we started up the same year, 1976, and we came to Louisiana, our first year fishing.
You know of any women captains out there?
No, they never had any women captains on the boat. Now, they had women captains that's on crew boats, supply boats, like that. But as far as commercial fishing, we never had one for the companies that I have worked for that have changed names from Seacoast to Zapata to Omega to Coastal Harvest. No, that we haven't had one.
What are some other fisheries? Zapata? What was Standard?
Standard, yeah, there was a Standard in Virginia and in Mississippi. They were competition like Seacoast was. Seacoast was owned by the Smith brothers. That was my first job in the fishing business with Seacoast. Matter of fact, first ones to give me the opportunity to be a captain, I worked for Seacoast Products.
the difference between fishing the waters, the Chesapeake Bay, the Northern Neck, versus going down to Louisiana or going to New Jersey? What helped make decisions about which waters you were going to be the master of?
Well, with myself, I wanted to be the master of them all because I wanted to learn how to fish in all of those areas. And in my career, I did that. I fished a boat in New Jersey. We used to go all the way almost to Nova Scotia to catch pogie fish. We worked in Portland, Maine a lot, so I would have to navigate the boat from New Jersey across the Ambrose Channel into New York City. I always tell people I've been under the bridges, over the bridges, and across the bridges. All of the bridges in New York City, I would go through the city and go up Long Island Sound, on up to Rhode Island, on up to Cape Cod Canal, and I would go through the canal and hit Boston and go on across the Atlantic until I got to Portland, Maine. And then sometimes I would leave New Jersey, and we would actually come all the way to the Chesapeake Bay, catch fish there. So we had to do that also. So I would come all the way to Virginia to catch fish and bring them all the way back to New Jersey to be processed. And then I worked in the fall of the year at Zapata in Reedville, and we would run all the way to North Carolina, catch fish, and bring them all the way back to Reedville, Virginia. So I have been to Morgan City, Louisiana, and I have been from Morgan City to Mississippi to catch fish and bring them from Mississippi back to Louisiana to be processed. And I've also worked in Abbeville, Louisiana, which I am there now, and I would actually go in there and catch fish and go all the way to Texas and catch a load of fish and bring them all the way back to Abbeville. And then I went to Cameron, Louisiana, and that was my home base for 35 years. I worked out of Cameron, and I used to go all the way to Mexico, go fish to catch a load of fish and bring them back to Cameron. Or I would leave Cameron and go almost all the way to Mississippi to catch a load and bring them back to Cameron. So I have conquered not the seven seas, but all of the water where commercial fishing was. Yeah.
Compare the type of technology that you are working with today versus to what we're using back in the day. How has changed?
Well, back in the day with those guys, I used the same thing they used back in the day. When I became a captain, all we had was a compass and a hand control, which we steered the boat. We had no automatic pilot. Some of us didn't even have a radar. Radar came later on. As far as to have some navigation equipment, we had none. You had to go simply by the knowledge that you was taught, and you had to be taught well, because I had to learn how to use a compass and my watch to know where I was going by the knots that the boat ran and my time as far as to get from point A to point B. It would put me in the vicinity, especially when you had fog, bad weather, darkness. You really had to know that you knew that you knew that you knew what you were doing as far as to navigate a boat. And especially up north in the Atlantic, man, it was a little different up there because you ran north, east, south, and west. But in the Gulf, you ran mostly east and west where your boundary is there. But as far as with Captain Gus and Captain Hill,
Mr. Dunaway, Clinton Hill,
those guys, man, like I said, when I decided that this was going to be what I like to do or what I wanted to do, I took the knowledge that I was taught. But the newer generation can teach you an easier way, and I could plot a course with just using my compass and a chart. You know, I learned how to use the parallel rules and course protractors, because once we did get the modern equipment like a Loran GPS and the Pinpoint computers and the NavTech, which we haven't had them that long. We have had the Loran came out first to help us, because you could punch in your coordinates, which is your longitude and your latitude, and it would give you your time of arrival to where you were going and give you your course that you would run. And it would also tell you, you know, what time you were going to get there. But see, it was good to learn it the hard way, because sometimes that equipment would go out, so you would have to know it in your head. I'm glad I was taught by the old school, you know. And like I said, my method of plotting the course by not taking the chart down and doing it in my head with the compass they was like, no, you can't do that. But I proved them wrong by, you know, using your chart. You got your distance of 5 miles to a block. And then I would say, if we're going to run southwest, I could figure that out in my head and get a course. And I could take it in my head and do it in my head in 2 minutes. And they would take and pull the charts down and put the chart on the table and plot a course. And they would write theirs down on the paper, and I write mine down on the paper. And we would only be a few degrees off, but the time would be the same. So
nice.
Like, well, how did you do that, man? But like I said, it's just when I became a captain, I observed a lot of the old ways, and I brought a lot of my new ways in, and I made fishing a lot more easier. You know, and that's what we have done as captains. We have taken the old-fashioned way of pull, 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 and we had modified it into letting the hydraulics modify things where it didn't break us down like it did our ancestors and our forefathers who did it before us. You know, it's much easier now, and we have less men now also, and we catch more fish now. So it has been a challenge as far as to make it better. And we as black captains, we have mostly made the changes, but of course we'll never get credit for it. But
yes, we know.
I'm sure it made my work easier.
I was listening to you talk about pulling those nets. I was thinking about my Uncle Carl when they were saying how they had to clean the nets every night and how they would pull them and how heavy they were and have to scrub the lines and the nets and then put it on top of the house so it could dry so they can use it the next day. And that was a daily thing. But he was talking about the fish that was being hauled. And I guess that's where the chanty singers were help the men hauling those nets in. And my grandfather, Clinton Hill, and I think his brother, my dad's uncle, they were chanty singers. When you were on any of those boats, were there chanty singers?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had chanty singers in our crews that weren't chanty singers. But boy, they were the best chanty singers that you ever wanted to hear because they could sing. So that's another thing. You know, when the chanter singers got together or when the chanter singers started, and I don't exactly know the history of when the first chanter singers started, but I do know that it was back in the day when we didn't have the power blocks and we had about 20-some men to the boats and they had dry boats in the net. They were catching very few fish, but all of those men had to pull those nets. And just with that hard work, I'm singing from black men, we're always trying to ease the pain and make the job a whole lot easier, especially with that harmonizing that they would do. And I had the opportunity to be in crews, and it was something like the military, you know, when the guys are marching, drill instructors singing, and of course they are backing them up. Fishing was the same way, and they called it Shanty singers, and it was really something to hear. Because at the time when it first started, I did know that I was looking at history. Just thought it was something that they did on the fish boats. Like, you know, I was a very young boy going on the fish boat with older guys. I was 17 years old when I did it professionally. I went on the boat when I was young with my father, 10, 11, 12 years old. So, and I saw that going on. And they always had, it seemed like every crew always had a singer that would start it off. And then the rest of the guys would, you know, they would come in with the background, like the Temptation, four times. And that was a beautiful thing. And now the young guys, now they'll do some rap now. So I don't think they'll ever have the rap singers fishing, but now, like I said, with less men, but they still got a lot of trash talkers now, and it makes the job easier. And they have the things that they say, but the chanting and the chattering is something that makes the day go by. And once they start, everybody will join in. And it really does make the job easier. But the generation now, we don't do that pulling no more. I modified mine. I would actually study what we were doing. And I could visualize it in my head. And I said, how can I eliminate all of us sitting up in this bow and pulling these fish up? It was a hard job, man. and I modified some things, and I tried it, and it worked. Now a lot of people are doing it the way I did it. And I've had white guys come on my boat that was in training. He said, well, Captain Matt, I've never seen it done like that before. I told him, we just do things different. Each captain does. You know, if you fish with me, and then you went and fish with Carl, then you went and fish with Gus, all three of us fish different. You know what I mean? But we did it in our own way. Of course, the results came up the same way because we caught fish. But I just did it in a much faster way. And men like working for me because they said, man, it's easy working for Captain Matt. But they just didn't know what I was doing. I was modifying my net. Like I said, I used to just think of things to make the job easier. Yep.
The men who are no longer with us in flesh, but in spirit, men who are still with us, who help pave the way for a new generation, men who still honor the tradition of passing on the knowledge and experience of living on the waters of the Northern Neck and beyond her shores, the struggles, the joys, the hopes of what living and working in this dangerous world of harvesting the waters still convey to the men who chose the life of being on the water. For some of these men, these were the only choices while being black on the Northern Neck. The music by Robert A. Hall. This interview is dedicated to Clinton Winfield Hill and all the men of the Northern Neck who lost their lives while working on the waters in Louisiana. Thank you for listening.